morning, I don't know, goofed off with some bastard with a bottle.
Randy called. Bill, where's Bill? Bill McGovern was on the other side of the truck, he said. I'm here, Randy. Bill, go look in that car and see if you can find Dan's bag, and be sure those two back there are good and dead. Malachi choked again. Randy tried to ease him over on his side, but he began to bleed more from the stomach wound, so he had to let him be. Sam Hazard said,
I don't think this one's doing us any good. He's just holding us up. I think we should convoke a military tribunal right now and pass sentence. I vote he be executed.
So do I, Randy said, but I want him to hang. If he makes any trouble, let him have it, Sam, but I'd like to have him alive.
Bill came back with a cardboard carton. Nothing in that car except this. A little food in here. A few cans of sardines and corned beef hash and a box of matches. A couple of boxes of ammunition, that's all. Not a sign of Dan's bag. And the sedan is finished. It was in our line of fire, and it looks like a sieve with all that buckshot through it. There's gasoline all over the road.
Randy started the Model A and looked at the fuel gauge. It showed almost empty. He backed it away from the bridge entrance, put the key in his pocket, and left it. He said, we'll lift Malachi into the truck and get going. First I'll collect their weapons and ammo. He was thinking ahead. There would be other highwaymen, and this was armament for his company.
What about these? Bill asked, pointing his shotgun at the bodies.
Leave them. He looked up. The buzzer's already attended. I'll come back tomorrow, or we'll send somebody. Whatever they leave, he watched the black birds wheeling and swooping, we'll give to the river. One of the highwaymen trailing them had been Leroy Settle, the drugstore cowboy. When Randy examined his two guns, he was surprised to find that they were only .22 caliber lightweight replicas, except in bore, of the big Frontier .45s. His companion's pistol apparently had gone into the river, for it wasn't on the bridge, although he had a pocket full of ammunition. Then Randy leaned over the leader. He saw that his shots had all been good, the three in the belly making a neat pattern, diagonal tic-tac-toe. When he picked up the Thompson, the dead man's arm astonishingly rose with it, clinging as if his fingers were glued to the stock. Randy jerked it free and saw that it was glue of a sort. The man's hands were smeared with honey. It was after dark when Randy wheeled up to the front steps of the house. As he cut the engine, he heard Graff barking. All the downstairs windows showed light. Lib burst out of the door and ran down the steps, saw him at the wheel, and was there with her arms and lips when he got out. Preacher Henry appeared, and Two-Tone, Florence Wetcheck and Alice Cooksey, Hannah and Missouri, the children. Dan Gunn came out, robe flapping, carrying a lantern. They had all been waiting. The Admiral and Bill were in back with the prisoner and Malachi. Bill stepped out, holding a pistol, and then the man with the bat, called Casey, prodded by Sam Hazard's shotgun. Sam climbed down, and that left Malachi. Malachi had been unconscious after the first mile. Until they reached Fort Repose, the road had been very bad. Randy said, "Killed three, grabbed this one. They got Malachi through the middle." Look at him, Dan. Is he still with us, Sam? The Admiral said, he was a minute ago, barely. Randy said, Ben Franklin, get some clothesline. We're going to hang him right now? Ben asked, not casually, but still as if he expected it.
No, we'll tie him.
Dan crawled into the truck. He held up the lantern, shook his head in exasperation, and then tore the patch away from his right eye. The eye was still swollen, but not entirely shut, and any assistance to his left eye was helpful. He crawled out and said, he's in shock and shouldn't be moved, and ought to have a transfusion. But we have to move him if I'm to do anything at all. On what? There was a discarded door in the tool house. They moved him on that. They laid Malachi on the billiard table in the game room, and then masked lamps and candles so that Dan would have light. Dan said, I have to go into him. Massive internal hemorrhage. I've got to tie it off, or there's no chance at all.
How?
With what?
He leaped on the edge of the table, swaying not in fatigue or weakness, but in agony of frustration. He cried, "Oh, God!" Dan stopped swaying.
"A knife, Randy. My hunting knife, the one I shave with? It's sharp as a razor, almost. No, too big, too thick. How about steak knives?"
"Sure, steak knives."
The short-bladed steak knives even looked like lancets. The judge and Randy's mother had bought the set in Denmark on their summer in Europe in 54. They were the finest and sharpest steak knives Randy had ever used. He found them in the silver chest and called, "How many?"
"Two will do."
From the dining room, Helen called, "I've put on water to boil, a big pot." The dinner fire had been going, and Helen had piled on fat wood so it roared, and Dan would soon have the means of sterilizing his instruments. Randy put them into the pot to boil. After that, at Dan's direction, he put in his fine-nosed fishing pliers. Florence Wetchek ran across the road for darning needles. Lib found metal hair clips that would clamp an artery. Randy's 6-pound nylon line off the spinning reel would have to do for sutures. There was enough soap to cleanse Dan's hands. Dan went into the dining room, fretting, waiting for the pot and his instruments to boil. It was hopeless, he knew. In spite of everything they might do, sepsis was almost inevitable. But now it was the shock and the hemorrhage he couldn't lick. He wondered whether it would be possible to rig up a saline solution transfusion. They had the ingredients, salt and water and fire and somewhere, certainly, rubber tubing. He would not give up Malachi. He wanted to save Malachi, capable, quiet, and strong, more than he'd ever wanted to save anybody in his years as a physician. So many people died for nothing. Malachi was dying for something. In the game room, Helen was at work, quick and competent. She had found their last bottle of scotch, except what might remain in Randy's decanter upstairs, and was cleansing the wound with it. Randy and Lib stood beside her. The pool of blood in the round hole ebbed and did not rise again. The water was boiling in the big iron pot when Randy walked into the dining room and touched Dan's shoulder. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm afraid it's all over." In a dark corner of the room, where she thought she would be out of the way and not a bother, Hannah Henry had been sitting in an old scarred maple rocker. The rocker began to move in slow cadence, and she moaned in this cadence for the dead, arms folded over her empty breasts as if holding a baby, except that where the baby had been, there was nothing. Dan Gunn went into the game room and saw that Randy was correct, that Malachi was gone. His shoulders felt heavy. He was aware that his head throbbed and eyes burned. There was nothing more to do except empty the makeshift sterilizer with its ridiculous makeshift tools. He did this in the kitchen sink. Yet when he saw the knives and the pliers and the hair clips steaming, he realized they were not really so ridiculous. If he was very careful and skillful, he could make do with such tools. They had not and probably could not have saved Malachi. They might save someone else. A century ago, the tools had been no better and the knowledge infinitely less. Out of death, life. An immutable truth. Helen was at his side. He said, "Thanks, Helen, for the try. You're the best unregistered nurse in the world." "I'm sorry it was for nothing." "Maybe it wasn't for nothing. I'll just keep these and try to add to them. I wonder if we could find a small bag somewhere. Any little traveling bag would do."
"I have one, a train case."
"We'll start here, then, and build another kit." His eyes hurt.
Who in Fort Repose could build him another pair of glasses or give him new eyes?
At 9 o'clock that night, Randy's knees began to quiver, and his brain refused further work and begged to quit, a reaction he knew to the fight on the bridge and what had gone before and after, and lack of sleep. It was his wedding night. He had been married at noon that same day, which seemed incredible.
Noon was a life ago. But now that he was married, he thought it only right that he and Lib have a room to themselves in the privacy accorded a married couple. All the bedroom space was taken, and he hated to evict anyone. After all, they were all his guests. Yet since it was inevitable that beds and rooms be shifted around, the victim would have to be Ben Franklin, since Ben was the junior male. Ben would have to give up his room and take the couch in Randy's apartment, and Mr. and Mrs. Randolph Bragg would move into Ben's room. He was sitting on his couch, trying to still his quivering legs, face in his hands, thinking of this. Lib sat behind the bar drinking a warm limeade. She was thinking of the problem also, but was reluctant to mention it, feeling that it was the husband's duty, and she should allow him to bring it up. Her father came in, a thin and wan Caesar in his sandals and white robe. Bill McGovern had been standing guard over the trussed prisoner, wondering the while that he had killed a man that day and felt no guilt at the time or after. It was like stepping on a roach. He had just been relieved by Two-Tone Henry, who had left his house of mourning to assume the duty. Bill asked for Dan. Randy lifted his head and told him that Dan, exhausted by being too long on his feet, slept. "Well, I'll tell you then, but I don't suppose it will do any good tonight." He spoke directly to his daughter. "I didn't know what to give you for a wedding present, Elizabeth. There's a good deal of real estate in Cleveland, but I don't suppose it'll ever be worth much now. There are bonds and stock certificates in our safe deposit vault right here in Fort Repose, and the cash, well, the Confederate money in Randy's chest is just as good. You can have the house and property down the road if you want it, but I don't think anybody can ever live there unless electricity comes back. So I thought, what can I give Lib and Randy? I talked it over this morning with Dan. He made a suggestion, and we decided to give you a present jointly from the best man and the father of the bride." Bill looked from one to the other and saw they were interested. "We're jointly making you a present of this whole apartment. Dan is going to move in with me." Lib said, "That's perfectly wonderful, Father." Bill said hesitantly, "Only, if Dan's asleep, I don't think we ought to disturb him, do you?"
"No, not tonight," Lib said. She kissed her father, and she kissed her husband, and she went across the hall to her old room. Randy fell across the couch and slept. Presently, Graff jumped up beside him and snuggled under his arm.
At noon Monday, the man with the bat was hung from a girder supporting the bandstand roof in Marines Park. All the regular traders and a number of strangers were in the park. Randy ordered that the corpse not be cut down until sunset. He wanted the strangers to be impressed and spread the word beyond Fort Repose. While he had not planned it, on this day he accepted the first enlistments in what came to be known as Bragg's Troop, although in orders he called it the Fort Repose Provisional Company. 7 men volunteered that day, including Fletcher Kennedy, who had been an Air Force fighter pilot, and Link Haslip, a West Point cadet who had been home on Christmas leave on the day. He created them Provisional Lieutenants of Infantry. The other 5 were even younger, boys who had finished 6 months of reserve training after high school or had been in the National Guard. After the execution, Randy posted the notices he had typed earlier and brought to the park in his uniform pocket. The first read, "On 17 April, the following highwaymen were killed on the covered bridge. Mickey Cahane of Las Vegas and Boca Raton, a gambler and racketeer. Arch Phlegert, Miami, occupation unknown. Leroy Settle, Fort Repose. On 18 April, Thomas Casey Killinger, also of Las Vegas, and the 4th member of the band which murdered Mr. and Mrs. James Hickey and robbed and assaulted Dr. Daniel Gunn, was hung on this spot." The second notice was shorter. "On 17 April, Technical Sergeant Malachi Henry, USAF Reserve, died of a wound received on the covered bridge while defending Fort Repose. 12. Early in May, a tube in the Admiral's radio flared and died, cutting off the voice of the world outside. While these communications had always been sketchy and the information meager and confusing, the fact that they were gone entirely was a blow to everyone. The Admiral's shortwave receiver had been their only reliable source of news. It was also a fount of hope. Each night that reception was good, some of them had gathered in the Admiral's den and listened while he conned the wavelengths, hoping for news of peace, victory, succor, reconstruction. While they never heard such news, they could always wait for the next night with hope. After consulting with the Admiral and the Henrys, Randy posted a notice on his official bulletin board in Marines Park. He asked a replacement for the tube and offered handsome payment, a pig and two chickens, or a 5-year file of old magazines. A proper tube never came in. Before the day, the Admiral had been forced to order replacement tubes directly from the factory in New Jersey, so he had not been optimistic. Even had they been able to acquire a new tube, the radio could not have operated long, for the automobile batteries were depleted, and it was in May that gasoline vanished entirely. In June, Preacher Henry's corn crop ripened, the sweet yam swelled in the ground, and the first stalks of two-tone sugarcane fell to the machete. June was the month of plenty, the month in which they ate corn pone and hoe cake with molasses. In June, they all fleshed out. It was in June also that they ran their first batch of mash through the still built by Bill McGovern and Two-Tone. It was an event. After pine knots blazed for 3 hours under a 50-gallon drum, liquid began to drip from the spout, terminating an intricate arrangement of copper tubing, coils, and condensers. Two-Tone caught these first drops in a cup and handed it to Randy. Randy sniffed the colorless stuff. It smelled horrible. When it had cooled a bit, he tasted it. His eyes watered, and his stomach begged him not to swallow. He managed to get a little down. It was horrid. "It's wonderful," he gasped, and quickly passed the cup on. After all the men had taken a swallow and properly praised Two-Tone's inventive initiative and Bill's mechanical acumen, Randy said, "Of course, it's still a little raw. With aging, it'll be smoother." "It ought to be aged in the wood," Bill said. "Where will we get a keg?" "It'll be a cinch," Randy said. "Anybody who has a keg will trade it for a couple of quarts after it's aged." But for Dan Gunn, the corn whiskey was immediately useful. While he would not dare use it for anesthesia, he estimated its alcohol content as high. It would be an excellent bug repellent, liniment, and preoperative skin antiseptic. One day in July, Alice Cooksey brought home 4 books on hypnotism and presented them to Dan Gunn. "If you can learn hypnotism," she suggested, "you might use it as anesthesia." Dan knew a number of doctors, and dentists, too, who commonly practiced hypnotism. It had always seemed to him an inefficient and time-consuming substitute for ether and morphine, but now he grasped at the idea as if Alice had offered him a specific for cancer. Every night, Helen read to him. She insisted on doing his reading, thus saving his eyes. They no longer had candles or kerosene, but their lamps and lanterns burned furnace oil, extracted from the underground tanks with a bilge pump. It was true that furnace oil smoked and stank and produced yellow and inefficient light. But it was light. Soon, Dan hypnotized Helen. He then hypnotized, or attempted hypnosis, on everyone in River Road. He couldn't hypnotize the Admiral at all. He succeeded in partially hypnotizing Randy with poor results, including grogginess and a headache. Randy attempted to cooperate, but he could not erase everything else from his mind. The children were excellent subjects.
Dan hypnotized them again and again until he had only to speak a few sentences in the jargon of the hypnotist, snap his fingers, and they would fall into malleable trance. Randy worried about this until Dan explained, "I've been training the children to be quick subjects, because in an emergency, they have their own built-in supply of ether." "And if you're not around?" "Helen is studying hypnotism, too." He was thoughtful. "She's becoming quite expert. You know, Helen could have been a doctor. Helen isn't happy unless she's caring for someone. She takes care of me." A week later, Ben Franklin developed a stomach ache which forced him to draw up his right knee when he tried to lie down. The ache was always there, and at intervals it became sharp pain enveloping him in waves. Dan decided Ben's pain was not from eating too many bananas. It was impossible to take a blood count, but the boy had a slight fever, and Dan knew he had to go into him. Dan operated on the billiard table in the game room after putting Ben into deep trance. Dan used the steak knives, darning needles, hair curlers, and nylon line, all properly sterilized, and removed an appendix, distended and near to bursting. In 5 days, Ben was up and active. After that, Randy, somewhat in awe, referred to Dan as our witch doctor. In August, they used the last of the corn, squeezed the last of the late oranges, the Valencias, and plucked the last overripe but deliciously sweet grapefruit from the trees. In August, they ran out of salt. Armadillos destroyed the yam crop, and the fish stopped biting. That terribly hot August was the month of disaster. The end of the corn and exhaustion of the citrus crop had been inevitable. Armadillos in the yams was bad luck, but bearable. But without fish and salt, their survival was in doubt. Randy had carefully rationed salt since he was shocked in July to discover how few pounds were left. Salt was a vital commodity, not just white grains you shook on eggs. Dan used saline solutions for half a dozen purposes. The children used salt to brush their teeth. Without salt, the slaughter of the Henry pigs would have been a terrible waste. They planned to tan one hide to cut badly needed moccasins, and without salt this was impossible. As soon as they were out of salt, it seemed that almost everything required salt, most of all the human body. Day after day, the porch thermometer stood at 95 or over, and every day all of them had manual labor to do and miles to walk. They sweated rivers, they sweated their salt away, and they grew weak, and they grew ill. And all of Fort Repose grew weak and ill, for there was no salt anywhere. In July, Randy had gone to Rita Hernandez, and she had traded 5 pounds of salt to him for 3 large bass, a bushel of Valencias, and 4 buckshot shells. She had traded not so much for these things, Randy believed, but because he had helped her arrange decent burial for Pete and provided the pallbearers to carry him to repose in Peace Park. Since July, he had been unable to trade for salt anywhere. In Marines Park, a pound of salt would be worth 5 pounds of coffee, if anyone had coffee. You could not even buy salt with corn liquor, potent if only slightly aged. In August, the traders in Marines Park dragged themselves about like zombies for want of salt. And for the first time in his life, Randy felt a weird uneasiness and craving that became almost madness when he rubbed the perspiration from his face and then tasted salt on his fingers. Now he understood the craving of animals for salt, understood why a cougar and a deer would share the same salt lick in the enforced truce of salt starvation. But even more important than salt was fish, for the fish of the river was their staple, like seal to the Eskimo. It had been so simple until August. Their bamboo-set poles, butts lodged in metal or wooden holders on the ends and sides of their docks, each night usually provided enough fish for the following day. In the morning, someone would stroll down to the dock and haul up whatever had hooked itself in the hours of darkness. If the Knight's automatic catch was lean, or if extra fish were needed for trading, someone was granted leave from regular chores to fish in the morning, or at dusk when the feeding bass struck savagely. Their poles grew in clumps. They had line aplenty, hooks enough to last for years. Fishing had been the pre-day hobby of Bill McGovern and Sam Hazard, as well as Randy, and every kind of bait. Worms, crickets, grasshoppers, tadpoles, minnows, shiners, for anyone capable of using a shovel, throw net, or simply his hands. Randy had more than 100 plugs and spoons and perhaps half as many flies and bass bugs. He had bought them knowing well that most lures are designed to catch fishermen rather than fish. Still, on occasion, the bass would go wild for artificials, and in the spring the specks and bream would snap up small flies and tiny spoons. So fish had never been a problem until they stopped biting. When they stopped all at once and all together. Even with his circular shrimp net wading barefoot in the shallows, Lib beside him hopefully carrying a bucket, Randy could not net a shiner, bream, cat, or even mudfish. Randy considered himself a good fisherman, and yet he admitted he didn't understand why fish bit or why they didn't. August had never been a good month for black bass, true, but this August was strange. Only during thunderstorms was there a ripple on the river. A molten sun rose, grew white hot, and sank red and molten, and the river was unearthly still and oily, agitated no more than Florence's aquarium. Even at crack of dawn or final light, no fish jumped or swirled. It was bad. And it was eerie and frightening. In the third week of August, when they were all weak and half sick, Randy spoke his fears to Dan. It was evening. Randy and Lib had just come from the hammock. For an hour, they had crouched together under a great oak, waiting for the little gray squirrels to feed. They had been utterly quiet, and the squirrels had been noisy, and Randy had blasted two of them out of the tree with his double 20, a shameful use of irreplaceable ammunition for very little meat. Yet two squirrels was enough to give meat flavor to a stew that night. What they would have for breakfast, if anything, nobody knew. They found Dan in Randy's office with Helen trimming his hair. Randy told them about the two squirrels, and then she said, "Dan, I've been thinking about the fish. I've never seen fishing this bad before. Could anything big and permanent have happened? Could radiation have wiped them out or anything?" Dan scratched at his beard, and Helen brushed his hand down and said, "Sit still." Dan said, "Fish. Let me think about fish. I doubt that anything happened to the fish. If the river had been poisoned by fallout right after the day, the dead fish would have come to the surface. The river would have been blanketed with fish. That didn't happen then, and it hasn't happened since. No, I doubt there has been a holocaust of fish." "It worries me," Randy said. "Salt worries me more. Salt doesn't grow or breed or spawn. You either have it or you don't." Helen swung the swivel chair. Dan was facing the teak chest. Suddenly he lifted himself out of the chair, flung himself on his knees, opened the chest, and began to dig into it. "The diary," he shouted. "Where's the diary?"
"It's there. Why?"
"There's salt in the diary. Remember when Helen was reading it to me after I was slugged by the highwaymen? There was something about salt in it. Remember, Helen?"
Randy had not looked into the log of Lieutenant Randolph Rousey Payton for years, but now it was coming back to him, and he did remember.
Lieutenant Payton's Marines had also lacked and needed salt, and somehow obtained it. He dropped on his knees beside Dan and quickly found the log. He skimmed through the pages. Lieutenant Payton, as he recalled it, had run out of salt in the second year. He found an entry, dated August 19th, 1839.
"The supply boat from Cowes Ford being much overdue, and my command lacking salt and suffering greatly from the heat, on 6 August I dispatched my loyal creek guide, Billy Longnose, down the St. John's, sometimes called River May, to discover the cause of delay.
Today, he returned with the information that our supply boat, beating its way upstream, had put into dock at Mandarin, a town named to honor the Oriental nation from which it imported its orange trees. By ill luck, on that night, the Seminoles raided Mandarin, putting to death a number of its inhabitants and burning the houses. The master of the supply boat, a civilian, and his crew, consisting of a white man and two slaves, escaped to the woods and later reached St. Augustine. However, the boat was pillaged and then burned. All other privations my men can endure except lack of water and lack of salt.
The next entry was dated August 21. Randy read it aloud. Billy Long Nose today brought to the fort a Seminole, a very dirty and shifty-eyed buck calling himself Cayucan, who offered to guide me to a place where there is sufficient salt to fill this fort 10 times over. So he says, in payment, he demanded 1 gallon of rum. While it is unlawful to sell spirits to the Seminoles, nothing is said about giving them drink. Accordingly, I offered the buck a 1/2-gallon jug, and he agreed.
Randy turned the page and said, here it is, 23, April.
This day, I returned to Fort Repose in the second boat, bringing 12 large sacks of salt. It was true. I could have filled the fort 10 times over. The place is near the headwaters of the Timucuan. Some 22 nautical miles, I should judge, up that tributary. It is called by an Indian word, meaning Blue Crab Pool. The pool itself is crystal clear, like the Silver Springs. I thought it surrounded by a white beach, but then discovered that what I thought sand was pure salt. It was quite unbelievable. In this pool, there were blue crabs, such as are found only in the ocean, yet the pool is many miles inland and 200 miles from the mouth of the St. John, or May.
Randy closed the log, grinned, and said, I've heard of Blue Crab Run, but I've never been there. My father used to go there when he was a boy for crab feasts. He never mentioned salt. I guess salt didn't impress my father. It was always in the kitchen. He had plenty.
The next morning, the Fort Repose fleet set sail. 5 boats, commanded by an admiral whose last sea command had also been 5 ships, a supercarrier, 2 cruisers, and 2 destroyers. By August, most of the boats in Fort Repose had been fitted with sails cut from awnings, draperies, or even nylon sheets for the lighter outboards, and with keels or sideboards and hand-carved rudders. For the expedition up the Timucuan, Sam Hazard chose boats of exceptional capacity and stability. Randy's light fiberglass boat wasn't suitable, so Randy went along as the admiral's crew. With the south wind blowing hot and steady, they planned to reach Blue Crab Pool before night and be back in Fort Repose by noon the next day, for their speed would double on their return voyage downstream. Their 5 boats crewed 13 men, all well armed. It would be the first night Randy had spent away from Lib since their marriage, and she seemed somewhat distressed by this, but Randy had no fear for her safety or for the safety of Fort Repose. His company now numbered 30 men. It controlled the rivers and the roads. Knowing this, highwaymen shunned Fort Repose. The phrase deterrent force had been popular before the day and effective so long as that force had been unmistakably superior. Randy's company was certainly the most efficient force in Central Florida, and he intended to keep it so. Sitting at the tiller, gold-encrusted cap pushed back on his head, the wind singing through the stays, the admiral seemed to have sloughed off a decade.
You know, he said, when I was at the academy, they still insisted that we learn sail before steam. They used to stick us in catboats and make us whip back and forth on the Severn and learn knots and rigs and spars. I thought it was silly. I still do. But it is fun.
They reached a curve of the river, and Randy watched the captain's walk on his roof disappear behind the cypress and palms. It was fun, he thought, and it was quiet. In a sailboat, a man could think. He thought about the fish and what had happened to them, for his stomach was empty. Peyton Bragg was bored, disgusted, and angry. She had helped Ben Franklin plan the hunt. She'd even walked to town with Ben and helped him locate the books in the library that told about armadillos. The armadillo, they had learned, was a nocturnal beast that curled up deep underground in daylight hours. In the night, he burrowed like a mole just under the surface, locating and eating tender roots and tubers, in this case the Henry's yams. The exciting thing they learned was that in his native Central America, the armadillo was considered a delicacy. The armadillo was food. Then, when it came time for the hunt, Ben had refused to take her along. A girl couldn't stay out all night in the woods, Ben said. It was too dangerous for a girl. She would have presented her case to Randy for judgment, but Randy was gone with the admiral, and her mother agreed with Ben. So Ben had gone off that evening with Caleb and Graff. It was Ben's contention that Graff was the key to armadillo hunting, and so it had proved. In Germany, the dachshund was originally bred as a badger hound, which meant that he could dig like mad and would fearlessly and tenaciously pursue any animal underground. Ben had been armed with a machete and his .22 rifle, but it was Caleb's spear that had been the effective weapon against armadillos. They had gone to the yam patch in the moonlight. The whole patch was plowed with armadillo runs. Ben introduced Graff to an opening, and Graff, sniffing and understanding at once, had wormed his way into the earth. Presently, there came an awful snarling and growling from a corner of the patch. Locating the armadillo from Graff's sounds, Caleb prodded it with his spear, and the armadillo burst out. This eruption so surprised Ben that he shot it. The others he decapitated with the machete. In the morning, five armadillos had been laid out in the Henry's barn. Two-Tone and Preacher cleaned them, and Peyton had eaten armadillo for breakfast. She would have choked on it, except that it was tender and delicious, and she was starving. Ben Franklin was credited with discovering a new source of food and was a hero. Peyton was only a girl, fit for sewing, pot washing, and making beds. Peyton threw herself on the bed and stared at the ceiling. She wanted to be noticed and praised. She wanted to be a hero. She recently had been talking to Lib about psychology, a fascinating subject. She had even read one of Lib's books. "I'm rejected," she told herself aloud. If she wanted to be a hero, the best way was to catch some fish. She set her mind to the problem. Why won't the fish bite? She had heard the admiral say that the best fisherman on the river was Preacher Henry, and yet she knew that Randy hadn't talked to Preacher about the no fish. If anybody could help, Preacher could. She got up, smoothed the bed, and sneaked down the back stairs. This was her day to sweep upstairs. She would finish when she got back. Peyton found Preacher in the cool of his front porch, rocking. Preacher was getting very old. He didn't do much of anything anymore except rock. Preacher was the oldest person Peyton had ever seen. Now that he had grown a white beard, he looked like a dark prophet out of the Bible. Peyton said, "Preacher, can you tell me something?" Preacher was startled. He hadn't seen her slip up on him, and her voice had broken his dream. He started to rise and then sank back into the chair.
"Sure, Peyton," he said. "What do you want to know?"
"Why don't the fish bite?"
Preacher chuckled. "They do bite. They bite whenever they eat."
"Come on, Preacher. Tell me how I can catch some fish."
"To catch fish, you got to think like a fish. Can you think like a fish, little girl?"
Peyton felt injured being called a little girl, but she was a child of dignity, and it was with dignity that she answered, "No, I can't, but I know that you can. You must.
because you're a great fisherman.
Preacher nodded in agreement.
I was a great fisherman. Now I feel too poorly to fish. Nobody thinks of me anymore as a great fisherman. They only think of me as an old man of no use to anyone. You are the first one to ask, why don't the fish bite? So I'll tell you.
Peyton waited.
If it was very hot, like now, the hottest I ever remember, and you was a fish, what would you do?
I don't know, Peyton said. I know what I do. I take showers 3 or 4 a day, outside with nothing on.
Preacher nodded. The fish, he wants to stay cool, too. He don't hang around the shore there. His arm swept to indicate the riverbanks. He goes out into the middle. The water close to the shore, it's hot. You put your hand in it, it feels like soup. But out in the middle of the river, way down deep, it's nice and cool. Down there, the fish feels lively and hungry, and he eats, and when he eats, he bites.
Bass?
Yes, big bass, way down deep.
How would I get them? Nobody's been able to net any bass bait, no shiners.
That's the trouble, Preacher said. The little fish, he gets hot too. So he's out there in the middle deep, being chased by the big fish, like always.
Peyton thought of something. Would a bass bite a goldfish?
Preacher looked at her suspiciously. He sure would. He'd take a goldfish in a second if one was offered. But it against the law to fish with goldfish. But if I did have goldfish, and if it weren't against the law, and if I did fish out in the deep channel, and then I wouldn't use a bobber. I'd just put a little weight next to my hook so that goldfish would sink right down where the big bass lie.
Peyton said, thank you, preacher,
and skipped away, not wishing to incriminate him further if it really was true that goldfish were illegal.
She went home, found a bucket on the back porch, and then walked across River Road for a talk with Florence Wetcheck. She and Florence were good friends and often had long talks, but about simple subjects, such as mending. Florence wasn't home. She was probably in town helping Alice at the library, but the goldfish were. She watched them, swimming dreamily, ignoring her in their useless complacency. "In with you," she said, and dumped fish and water into the pail. She borrowed Ben Franklin's rod and reel and made for the dock. She was forbidden to go out in Randy's boat alone, but since she was already involved in one criminal act, she might as well risk another. At noon, Randy had not returned, and Elizabeth McGovern Bragg climbed to the captain's walk where she could be alone with her fears and anxiety. Her father and Dan Gunn had walked to town that morning. With some volunteers from Bragg's troop, they had begun to clean up and repair the clinic. So there was no man in the house, and she was afraid for her husband. He had told her there would be no danger, but in this new life the dangers were deadly and unpredictable. She kept her face turned steadily to the east, where the Admiral's striped awning sail should appear at the first bend of the Timucuan. She told herself that she was silly, that Randy and the others, if they found the place at all, might tarry there for hours. They would undoubtedly feast on crab, and she couldn't blame them. They might find it difficult to load the salt. Anything could delay them. From the grass behind the kitchen, Helen called up. Lib! She leaned over the rail. Yes. Is Peyton up there with you?
No, I haven't seen her.
Is she out on the dock?
Lib looked out at the dock and saw that Randy's boat was missing. Before she told Helen this, she scanned the river. It was nowhere in sight. Randy had sailed in the Admiral's cruiser, and the boat should be there.
At 5 that evening, the Fort Repose fleet sighted Randy's house. There was no doubt that it had been a triumphant voyage. The 5 boats were deep with salt. The 13 men were filled with boiled crabs, lavishly seasoned, so they were all stronger and felt better, and in every boat there were buckets and washtubs filled with live crabs.
The Admiral ran his boat alongside Randy's dock and turned into the wind.
"You unload what salt you want here," Sam Hazard said, "and that wash tub full of crabs, and I'll sail back with the Henry's share and mine."
Randy unloaded. He had expected that Lib would be down at the dock to greet him, or certainly watching from the captain's walk. Coming home with such rich cargo, he was chagrined. He lifted the wash tub to the dock and then two fat sacks of salt. 50 pounds at least, he thought. It would last for months, and when it was gone, there was an unlimited supply waiting on the shores of Blue Crab Pool. He said, "So long, Sam. See you tonight." The Admiral pushed away from the dock, and Randy picked up the wash tub, deliberately spilled some of the water that had kept the crabs alive, and walked to the house. The kitchen was empty, except for 4 very large black bass in the sink. He lifted the largest, an 11-pounder, he judged. It was the biggest bass he had seen in a year. It was unbelievable. There was a plate on the kitchen table heaped with roasted meat. It looked like lamb. He tasted it. It didn't taste like lamb. It didn't taste like anything he'd ever tasted before, but it tasted wonderful. He thought of the crabs, and their value dwindled to hors d'oeuvres. It was then he heard the first sobs from upstairs, he thought, and then a different voice weeping hysterically somewhere else in the house. In fear, he ran through the dining room. 3 women were in the living room. They were all crying, Lib silently, Florence and Helen loudly. Lib saw him and ran into his arms and wiped her tears on his shirt. "What's happened?" he demanded.
"I thought you'd never come home," Lib said. "I was afraid, and there's so much trouble."
"What? Who's hurt?"
"Nobody but Peyton. She's upstairs crying. Helen spanked her and sent her to bed."
"Why?"
"She went fishing."
"Did Peyton catch those big bass?"
"Yes."
"And Helen spanked her for it?"
"Not that. Helen spanked her because she took out your boat and drifted downstream. We didn't know what had happened to her until she rowed home an hour ago. She said she couldn't make it sail right."
Randy looked at Helen. "And what's wrong with you?"
"I'm upset. Anybody'd be upset if they had to spank their child."
Florence wailed and her head fell on her arms. "What's wrong with her?"
"Somebody or something came in and ate her goldfish."
Florence raised her head.
"I think it must have been Sir Percy. I'm sure of it. I did love that cat, and now look how he behaves."
She wept again. Randy said, "Isn't anybody going to ask me whether I got salt?"
"Did you get salt?"
Lib asked. "Yes, 50 pounds of it. And if you women want it, you'll take the wheelbarrow down to the dock and lug it up." He went into the kitchen to clean the beautiful bass and put the crabs in the big pot. It was all ridiculous and stupid. The more he learned about women, the more there was to learn, except that he had learned this. They needed a man around. Then he found a tattered goldfish in the gullet of the 11-pounder. He examined it carefully, smiled, and dropped it into the sink. He would not mention it. There was enough trouble and confusion among all these women already.
So ended the hunger of August. In the 4th week, the heat broke, and the fish began to bite again. In September, school began. It was impractical to reopen the Fort Repose schoolhouse. It was unheated, and there was no water. Randy decided that the responsibility for teaching must rest temporarily with the parents. The regular teachers were scattered or gone, and there was no way of paying them. The textbooks were still in the schoolhouse for anyone who needed them. Judge Bragg's library became the schoolroom in the Bragg household, and with Lib and Helen dividing the teaching. When Caleb Henry arrived to attend classes with Peyton and Ben Franklin, Randy was a little surprised. He saw that Peyton and Ben expected it, and then he recalled that in Omaha, and indeed in 2/3 of America's cities, white and Negro children had sat side by side for many years without fuss or trouble. In October, the new crop of early oranges began to ripen.
The juice tasted tart and refreshing after months without it. In October, armadillos began to grow scarce in the Fort Repose area, but the Henry's flock of chickens had increased, and the sow again farrowed. Also, ducks arrived in enormous numbers from the north, more than Randy ever before had seen. Wild turkeys, which before the day had been hunted almost to extermination in Timucan County, suddenly were common. Randy fashioned himself a turkey call and shot one or two every week. Quail roamed the groves, fields, and yards in great coveys. He did not use his shells on such trifling game, but Two-Tone knew how to fashion snares and taught the boys, so there was usually quail for breakfast along with eggs. One evening, near the end of the month, Dan Gunn returned from his clinic smiling and whistling. "Randy," he said, "I have just delivered my first post-day baby. A boy, about 8 pounds, bright and healthy." "So what's so wonderful about delivering a baby?" Randy said. "Was the mother under hypnosis?" "Yes, but that's not what was wonderful." Dan's smile disappeared. "You see, this was the first live baby, full term. I had two other pregnancies that ended prematurely. Nature's way of protecting the race, I think, although you can't reach any statistical conclusion on the basis of three pregnancies. Anyway, now we know that there's going to be a human race, don't we?" "I'd never really thought there might not be." "I had," Dan said quietly. In November, a tall pine split by lightning during the summer dropped its brown needles and died, and Randy and Bill felled it with a two-man saw and axe. It was arduous work, and neither of them knew the technique. It was at times like this that Randy missed and thought of Malachi. Nevertheless, they got the job done and trimmed the thick branches. The wood was valuable, for another winter was coming. Randy went to bed early that night, exhausted. He woke suddenly with a queer sound in his ears, like music, almost. He looked at his watch. It was a bit after midnight. Lib slept quietly beside him. He was frightened. He nudged her. She lifted her head and her eyes opened. "Sweetheart," he said, "do you hear anything?" "Go to sleep," she said, and her head fell back on the pillow. It bounced up again. "Yes," she said, "I do hear something. It sounds like music. Of course, it can't be music, but that's what it sounds like." "I'm relieved," Randy said. "I thought it was in my head." He listened intently. "I could swear that it sounds like In the Mood. If I didn't know better, I could swear it was that great Glenn Miller recording." She kicked him. "Get up, get up." He flung himself out of bed and opened the door to the upstairs living room, lit by a lamp on the bar turned low. It was necessary to keep fire in the house, for they no longer had matches, flints, or lighter fluid. Randy thought it must be the transistor radio started up again, but at the same time he knew this was impossible because he long ago had thrown away the dead batteries. Nevertheless, he picked up the radio and listened. It was silent, yet the music persisted. "It's coming from the hall," Lib said. They opened the door into the hallway. The rhythm was louder, but the hall was empty. Randy saw a crack of light under Peyton's door. "Peyton's room," he said. He put his hand on the door handle, but decided it would be gentlemanly to knock first. After all, Peyton was 12 now. He knocked. The music stopped abruptly. Peyton said, in a small, frightened voice, "Come in." Peyton's room was illuminated by a lamp Randy had never seen before. Peyton didn't have a lamp of her own. On Peyton's desk was an old-fashioned hand-crank phonograph with flaring horn. Stacked beside it were albums of records. Randy said softly, "Put it on again, Peyton." Peyton stopped plucking at the front of her pajamas, hand-me-downs from Ben Franklin just as Ben's pajamas were hand-me-downs from Randy, so fast did children grow. She started the record from the beginning. Hearing it, Randy realized how much he had missed music, how music seasoned his civilization. In the Henry House, Missouri often sang, but in the Bragg house hardly anyone could carry a tune or even hum. Over the rhythm, Lib whispered, "Where did you get it, Peyton? Where did it come from?" "The attic. I went up the little ladder in the back hall. Mother will be furious. She told me never to go up there because the rungs were cracked and I might fall."
"Your mother was up in the attic a few months ago. She didn't see anything."
"I know. I was crawling around behind the big trunk, and there was a door, a board door, that looked like part of the wall. I opened it, and there was another room, smaller."
Randy said, "Why did you do it, Peyton?"
"I don't know. I was lonely, and there wasn't anything else to do, and I'd never been up there. You know how it is. When you've never been someplace, you want to go."
Randy opened one of the albums.
"Old 78s, he said, his voice almost reverent. "Classic jazz. Listen to this. By Tommy Dorsey, Come Rain or Shine. Stardust, Chicago. Carmen Cavallaro's Stormy Weather. Also Body and Soul, Artie Shaw's Back Bay Shuffle. All the best by the best. I guess I'm certain this must have been Father's collection. I've never seen this machine before, but I remember the records."
In the mood ended, Randy said,
"Turn it over, Peyton. No, put on this one."
"You're not angry, Randy?" Peyton said.
"Angry? I should say not.
I found some other stuff in there, too."
"Like what?"
"Well, there's an old-time sewing machine, the kind you work with your feet. There's some big kerosene lamps, the kind that hang. This one on the desk I found up there, too. All I had when I went up was a little stub candle. Then there's an old pot-bellied stove and a lot of iron pipe. Oh, and lots of other junk. I left it because I wanted to try the record player. The only other thing I brought down, I brought for you and Dan, Randy. It's there on the bed."
Randy picked up the black leather case. It looked familiar. He had seen it before. He opened it and saw the two matched straight-edge razors that had belonged to his father. He leaned over and kissed the top of Peyton's head.
"Don't worry about what your mother will say," he told her. "I'll handle everything for you. If I had medals to give, I would pin one on you, Peyton, right now." In this manner, Peyton became a heroine.
13. One morning in November, when Randy was breakfasting early and alone, Dan Gunn came downstairs smooth-shaven, his jaw looking oddly pallid in contrast to brown forehead, nose, cheekbones, and neck.
"Good morning," Randy said. "You swore you'd never shave again. Why?"
"Well," Dan said lamely, "I had the razor, and it seemed a shame not to use it after Peyton gave it to me. Then there was the soap."
Within the past few weeks, bars of homemade soap had appeared in Marines Park, produced by Mrs. Estes, who had been senior teller at the bank, and two former co-workers. Everyone agreed that it would be a prosperous and rewarding business.
"The truth, Dan," Randy said. "Helen asked me to do it. She said she was getting tired of trimming it."
"Oh, that's different. You'd better be home in time for dinner tonight. John Garcia just made another run up to Blue Crab Pool, and he's dropping off a wash tub of crabs here in exchange for 1 quart of lightning."
Dan said, "I'm very fond of Helen. I don't know what I'd do without her."
"Why do anything without her?"
"Randy, I want to marry her."
Randy rose from the table, bowed, and said, "I give you my blessing."
"It isn't funny."
"Marriage is rarely funny."
"She won't marry me."
"Then why did you shave off your beard?"
"Damn it, Randy. I love her. And she loves me. She admitted it. She wants to marry me. But she won't. She thinks there's a chance Mark's still alive. She's afraid that if we married, then Mark would turn up alive and there'd be one of those awful messes we've all heard about or read about. Like when men were reported dead in the Philippines or Korea and they turned up after the war in an enemy prison camp. They came home and found their wives happily married to someone else, Sometimes there were children. It's always a mess. It's happened, Randy said, but in this case I don't think there's a chance. Want me to talk to her? Dan rubbed his face where his beard had been. I feel naked. No, Randy, thanks. I don't think Helen would want it discussed. Not yet, anyway. She just has this feeling, and I'm afraid she'll have to empty it herself. It was in this month that the first low-flying plane frightened and exhilarated them. At irregular times, planes had been reported before, but always jets flying very high, usually no more than a silver splinter in the sky, or contrail in day, and only sound at night. But in the second week in November, a big four-engined transport roared over Fort Repose at 1,000 feet. It bore Air Force markings. In Marines Park, everyone screamed and waved. It did not even waggle its wings, but went on south. Dan Gunn, who was in town, saw it directly overhead. Randy heard and saw it from River Road. The Admiral, who was out on the river in his flagship, was able to observe it through binoculars. That night, Randy and Lib and Dan and Helen went to Sam Hazard's house to hear his opinion.
I noticed two cylinders slung under the wing, he said. Not extra gas tanks. I think they might be air traps. I think they might be taking radiation samples.
A week later, the same plane, or one like it, came over again. This time it circled Fort Repose, and a stream of what appeared to be confetti at the distance fell from its belly and drifted down on the riverbanks and in the town. Randy was in Marines Park at the time discussing an alarm system with officers of his company. Church bells had been used in England during the Second World War, and there were bells in the Catholic and Episcopal churches. It was possible to evolve a code by which his troopers could understand the type and location of the emergency. The plane came over and everyone yelled as before, as if they could hear up there. Then the leaflets fluttered down. They read, "Do not be alarmed." This leaflet comes from a United States Air Force plane conducting atmospheric surveys of the contaminated zones. At a future date, a more precise survey will be undertaken by helicopters. Should a helicopter land in or near your community, do not interfere with the activities of personnel aboard. Lend them your cooperation if requested. This activity is an essential preliminary to bringing relief to the contaminated zones. In a sense, it was disappointing. But it was something. It was something you could put your hands on, that you could feel, that had come from the outside. It was proof that the government of the United States still functioned. It was also useful as toilet paper. Next day, 10 leaflets would buy an egg and 50 a chicken. It was paper, and it was money. In December, the helicopter came. It made a fearful racket, windmilling over Fort Repose. At various open spaces, including Marines Park, it hovered low and dropped a long wire from its belly, a small cylinder on the end of the wire actually touching the earth. It was like a gigantic bug dipping for honey. It came up the Timequin and circled the Bragg house. The children were down at the dock. Helen and Lib were in the house. Randy was visiting with Sam Hazard. It circled 4 times. The 2 women ran up to the captain's walk. They had the best view. They waved their arms, and then Helen took off her pink apron and waved that. Inside the helicopter, they saw faces, and the pilot opened a window and waved back. Then it went away up the Timequin. In 5 minutes, Randy, the Admiral, and the children, all out of breath, were at the house. Helen was weeping. "He waved," she said. "He waved at us. Nobody else. Us. I'm sure he came just to see us." "Now let's not get too excited," Randy said. "It may be that he was just looking for people, not anyone in particular, and saw the kids out on the dock and then circled the house to encourage us and give us heart." Helen wiped her face with her apron. She said, "Oh, I wish he'd come back. Please, God, send him back." At that moment, they heard it coming back. The children ran up to the roof. Randy went outside and sat on the porch steps. He was still out of breath, and he wasn't going to run upstairs. If the damn helicopter wanted to see him, it would have to come here. He wouldn't go to it. Sam Hazard sat down beside him. Randy watched for it. From the sound, he knew it was circling again. It came low over the trees and hovered over the lawn. Everything else was overgrown and choked with weeds and sprouting saplings, but this single stretch between house and road Randy kept in lawn. It was one of Ben Franklin's chores to mow once a week, and it was a link between the house and the time before the day, like shaving. It hovered there and slowly lowered. Randy said, "It's coming in." He rose to receive it. Its wheels touched the ground, its engines cut off, and its rotors drooped and slowed. Peyton ran down the steps, and Randy grabbed her. "Don't go out there until the rotors stop," he ordered. "Cut your head off." Now that it was down, the helicopter looked ungainly and enormous. There were 5 men in it. The rotors stopped. They waited in stillness so complete that they heard the creak of hinges as the hatch opened. A metal ladder fell from its side, and 2 men climbed down. Plastic helmets covered their heads, and they were encased in silver, translucent plastic suits, oxygen tanks strapped to their backs. Like divers, Randy thought, or maybe spacemen. Peyton and Ben Franklin had run out on the lawn. Now they shrank back. One of the men, laughing silently inside his helmet, held up his hand in a gesture. "Wait." The 2 men carried machines that looked like miniature vacuum cleaners, a cylindrical nozzle in one hand, an oblong black box in the other. They allowed these nozzles to sniff at grass and earth.
"Geiger counters," Sam Hazard said. "Maybe we're hot."
One of the men approached them, hesitated, and selected Randy. He bent over and allowed the nozzle to sniff Randy's last pair of boat shoes, big toe protruding through the canvas, soles reinforced with possum hide. The nozzle investigated the tattered shorts, the belt, and finally Randy's hair. At each point, the head and the helmet glanced at a dial in the box. It was very efficient. The man swept off his helmet, slammed his hand on Randy's shoulder as if in congratulations, and called back to the helicopter, "Okay, Colonel, the terrain's clear and they're clear. You can come down." His back toward them, a man climbed down. He wore a blue zippered Air Force flight suit with the eagles of a full colonel on his shoulders. When he turned and stepped forward, Randy did not immediately recognize him, he was so changed. It was not until the man held out his hand and spoke that Randy saw it was Paul Hart, who had been a light colonel, sandy-haired instead of gray, his face cheery and freckled instead of lined and aged when he saw him last. Randy could think of nothing to say except, "Come on in, Paul, and bring your people. We're just about to sit down for lunch." Lib cried, "The quail!" and dashed into the house, letting the screen door bang. "My wife," Randy said. "It's her lunch day."
"Your wife?"
"Congratulations." "My wife. I'll save it for later." Randy saw that the men with the Geiger counters had stripped off their plastic suits. "You'll all have a drink before lunch," he suggested, thinking that this had been the proper thing to say long ago and would still be proper and expected.
"Why, I'd be delighted," Paul said. "I haven't had a drink since..."
He asked a question.
"You people haven't saved your liquor all this time, have you?"
"Oh, no. This stuff is new. Well, it's aged a bit in a charcoal keg. We think it's very good." He led them up to his apartment and mixed sours with the corn whiskey and fat, ripe limes. Then there were the introductions. There was a Captain Bayless, the pilot, a Lieutenant Smith, chief radiologist, and the 2 sergeant technicians. They all considered the sour very good, and Paul said, "It's impossible to find anything to drink, even in Denver. Not even beer. Shortage of grains, you know. Nobody would dare make his own whiskey in the clear zones. He'd go to jail. The older people say it's worse than prohibition." There were 1,000 questions Randy wanted to ask, but at that moment he only had time for one because Lib called from downstairs. Lunch was ready. The men all wore brassards with the letters D.C. on the right arms. "What's that?" Randy asked, touching Paul's brassard. "District of Columbia?"
"Oh, no," Paul said. "There isn't any District of Columbia. Denver's the capital. That stands for Decontamination Command. It's the biggest command nowadays and really the only one that counts. I was seconded to the D.C. last spring. I put in for a CZ right away and asked for Florida, and Florida was the CZ I got."
Paul Hart thought the soup was wonderful and said he had never tasted anything exactly like it before, and Randy replied that he wasn't surprised. They always kept the big soup pot simmering on the fire, and everything went into it. "This particular soup," he explained, "is sort of a combination, armadillo, gopher, and turkey carcass." Lib brought a dozen quail, and more were broiling, and placed pitchers of orange juice in front of them, and they all drank it greedily. Captain Bayless kept mumbling that he felt they were imposing, and that there were K-rations in the helicopter, and that he actually expected to find CZ people all starving, because certainly most of them were in other parts of the country. He also kept on eating. "How does it happen," Randy asked Hart, "that you found us?" Hart said,
"You haven't heard anything from my wife, Martha, have you?"
Randy shook his head, no, apprehending Paul's tragedy.
"Of course, that's why I asked for duty in this CZ. I wanted to find out what happened to Martha and the children."
He looked up.
"It was just a year ago, wasn't it, that I met you at McCoy Operations? Wasn't it on the day before H-Day?"
"H-Day? We just call it the day."
"Hell Day, or Hydrogen Day, or the day, it's the same thing."
"Yes, that was the last time I saw you."
"It was also the last day I saw Martha, except to kiss her goodbye the next morning. Post-strike, we went on to Kenya in Africa. When I got back to this country, I learned right away, of course, that McCoy received one. But it wasn't until I flew over Orlando last week that I gave up hope. I suppose you know what happened to Orlando."
Randy said, "Oh, no, nobody's been that far off."
"It's as if no man was ever there. Even the shapes of the lakes have changed, and there are a couple of lakes that weren't there before. Find my wife. I couldn't even tell where my house stood. I think they must have dropped a 5-megaton missile on McCoy and another on Orlando Municipal. Nothing stands. Everything is burned and still hot. It's the damn C-14 that does it."
C-14?
"Radioactive carbon. Its half-life is more than 5,000 years. That and U-238 and cobalt and strontium is what makes rebuilding impractical in the TD, the totally destroyed cities. You have to start somewhere else. Here, for instance. Did you know that you are living in the center of the largest clear area in the whole CZ?"
"No, I didn't, but I'm glad to find out." Helen had been waiting tensely to ask the question that she must ask, yet knowing the answer before she asked it, for had there been any other answer, Paul would have told her before now. She said, "Paul, nothing about Mark, I suppose?"
"I'm sorry, Helen. Nothing. There were a few survivors from Omaha, but Mark wasn't one of them. After all, it was a primary target with SAC headquarters. Offutt Field, itself an important base, and the biggest rail complex between Chicago and the coast all grouped together. I don't think we'll ever find out exactly what happened."
Helen nodded. "At least I know for sure. That's important to know." No tears, Randy thought. He glanced at the children. Ben Franklin stood firm, chin outthrust, taut facial muscles containing his emotions. But Peyton, eyes lowered, slipped away into the other room. Then for a long time, Hart and the lieutenant radiologist questioned Randy and Sam Hazard about the way things had gone in Fort Repose, taking notes and showing remarkable interest in details of how the emergencies were met. "Of course, we need everything," Randy said, "but the town could get along fine if only we had electricity, because if they had power, then they'd have water. They wouldn't have to boil it or haul it from springs as they do now.
It'll be a long time. A very long time, Hart said. Even major cities that weren't touched, cities in the clear zones, lost their electricity a month or so after H Day and don't have it back yet. The only towns which have had uninterrupted power were those served by hydroelectric plants, provided the plants were undamaged and the aqueducts intact. There aren't many.
What about the other towns in the clear zones? Randy asked. He noted how quickly you picked up the jargon of the post-day age. It was like entering a totally new environment, like joining the army.
To have light, Paul said, you either have to have water, power, or fuel. Most cities had supplies for a month or so. After that, darkness. Some of our big oil fields are still burning. The coal regions of Pennsylvania and West Virginia were saturated with fallout. But the transport problem is what really cripples us. Think what happened to the pipelines, the railroads, the ports. Our big hope is atomic power. Thank goodness we still have a big stockpile of nuclear fuel.
The radiologist and the two technical sergeants excused themselves. They were going to the river to bottle water samples. Randy said that if the river was hot, they'd all be hot, because ever since the day, they'd been living on the bounty of the river. Hart said that apparently the river was going to be all right, and this was hopeful.
If we're going to get this CZ on the road back, I think I'd like to start in this area. Of course you understand, Randy, that before we can be of much help to the CZs, we have to get the clear country in decent shape.
He shook his head. Some of our scientists think it will take 1,000 years to restore a saturated CZ like Florida or New Jersey to anything close to normal, even scratching the TD cities. He talked of the cities that remained and of the shortages and the epidemics and how fortunate they had been to live in Fort Repose. In the following year, the government was going to take a census, including the contaminated zones, if possible.
There's no use kidding ourselves, he went on. We're a second-class power now.
Tertiary would be more accurate. I doubt if we have the population of France, or rather, a population as large as France used to have. He talked of farm areas out of production for an indefinite period, and how the South American nations had begun lend-lease shipments to the northern continent, and how Thailand and Indonesia were contributing rice. Eventually, it was hoped that Venezuelan oil would alleviate the transport fuel shortage, although he doubted that in his lifetime he would again see gasoline for sale to private citizens. They listened, their eyes marbled, as if in shock. The technicians returned from the river. Paul Hart looked at his watch and said they would have to take off. It was necessary that they drop into a small field near Brunswick, Georgia, before dark. It was presently his headquarters, but in a few years he planned to rehabilitate Patrick Air Force Base on Cape Canaveral and transfer there. The enemy had overlooked Patrick, perhaps deliberately since it was a test, not an operational base, perhaps because the missile designed for it had gone elsewhere. They would never know. Hart was thoughtful for a moment, then he spoke to Randy.
You know, you and all your clear people can come out if you want. Of course, you'll have to have a physical and be officially cleared and processed, but I doubt that you'd have any trouble. I'll be back here in a week. We're short on choppers, but I could bring you out 2 or 3 at a time.
This was Randy's town, and these were his people, and he knew he would not leave them. Yet it was not right that he make this decision alone. He looked at Lib without finding it necessary to speak. She, knowing what was in his mind, simply smiled and winked. He said, I guess I'll stay, Paul.
And the others?
Randy wished Dan was with them, and yet he was confident he could speak for Dan.
We have our doctor here, Dan Gunn. If it wasn't for Dan, I don't think any of us could have made it. He saved this town, and I'm sure he wouldn't want to leave now.
He turned to Helen. Would he? Helen said quietly, I wouldn't and he wouldn't.
But there's one thing you have to do, Paul. Bring supplies for our doctor.
What's he need?
Everything. Everything that a hospital needs. But most of all, he needs a new pair of glasses.
I could requisition those for him, I think, if I had his prescription.
Helen said,
I know where it is. Don't you leave, Paul. Don't you dare.
She left the room and ran upstairs.
What about you, Admiral Hazard? Paul asked. What about the children? What about the two women who live across the road, the librarian and the telegraph gal?
Sam Hazard laughed. Colonel, I have a fleet under my command. If the Navy Department will give me a fleet, I'll go with you, not otherwise.
We don't have any fleets, Paul Hart said. All we've got left really are nuclear submarines. The subs saved us, I guess. The subs and the solid fuel rockets and some of the airborne missiles.
Lib said, Alice Cooksey and Florence Wetchick are in town, but they were talking about the possibility of going out only a few nights ago. They'll both want to stay. You see, they're terribly busy. They've never worked so hard or accomplished so much in their whole lives. And I don't know what Fort Repose would do without them. They're practically our whole education system, and they keep all the records.
Isn't anybody going? Hart asked.
Ben Franklin said, Not me. Peyton, who had quietly returned to the conference, said, Me either. Helen came downstairs with the prescription for Dan's glasses. They all walked out to the porch, and Randy went out with Paul to the helicopter. They shook hands. Randy said, Paul, there's one thing more. Who won the war? Paul put his fists on his hips and his eyes narrowed.
You're kidding. You mean you really don't know?
No, I don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody's told us.
We won it. We really clobbered him.
Hart's eyes lowered, and his arms drooped. He said, Not that it matters. The engine started, and Randy turned away to face the thousand-year night.
This has been an Audible, Inc. production of Alas, Babylon, written by Pat Frank. Narrated by Will Patton. Executive producer, Kristen Lang. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1959 by Pat Frank. Production copyright 2010 by Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.